but the man in black goes towards him and tries to like grab him, like he's gonna like lift him off.
And he goes,
Fezzik's just like, you're doing very well. I just want you to know that so you don't feel bad before you die.
He's such a good heart.
Evil Dead 2 was released this year. It released in the same year as Princess Bride as well.
87, you trippy bitch.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, after I let Lucas down like that, he started to enjoy the film. I, in that moment, recognized something that I learned from this film is that a kid needs a pressure release sometimes from an adult person, mm-hmm. You know?
Right. Well, it's also interesting the way that the grandpa says she doesn't get eaten by the eels at this time. Like, does she get eaten later on? Anyway, sorry. But no.
That phrasing is important.
But I do kind of get that. Like, I think back on this when I was a kid, and I think how much the tension is built up and how much you are at this point as the audience stuck in this world. Even though there's this framing device, you mm-hmm. are stuck in this world. And there's very few moments where they actually, like, take you out of it.
Well, three or four scenes in a row where we're used to having one or two, maybe lots of times just one before we cut back and forth between plot progress. Like, three scenes in 1987 is a long time. So the fact that they cut to him and you see Fred just like deflated, but in a very relief sort of way, like, it's really great storytelling. Rob Reiner did an amazing job of taking William Goldman's work and like refining it from a well-told story to a well-crafted film.
There were no shrieking eels in the actual novel.
That sounds like a Sean fact.
It was indeed a Sean fact. Instead, Buttercup jumps overboard to escape her captors, and Vicini warns her of sharks in the water, and he ends up filling a cup of his own blood and throwing it in the water to attract them.
Vicini's so hardcore.
Mm-hmm. Also, there's this moment where Fred Savage is like, I wasn't worried. Well, maybe I was a little bit concerned. And you see Peter Falco, like, he's like very unconvinced. My note was,
concerned and worried aren't the same thing.
Yeah. And I would say unconvinced grandpa is unconvinced. He makes a face anyways. Yeah.
But you can tell when a kid's trying to cover their ass emotionally.
Yeah. And so they go back into the story and they're like, oh, and then the shrieking eel starts to charge at her. And
grandpa, you read that part.
Oh, sorry. And so he goes back and he like does that thing where when you read a book and you have to like stop for a minute.
Yes.
And then you have to like go back. It's very like, it's a natural way of trying to get back into the story.
Doesn't he lick his finger to turn the page?
Like
too?
His thumb, like full on, like bottom of like the second knuckle of the thumb, all the way to the tip of the thumb. He's like, and then he like turns the page.
See, I don't notice those things.
It's real gross because I don't like people licking their fingers without washing their hands in between doing stuff.
Another sign this wasn't filmed during COVID.
Well, ever since junior high, if I watch you lick your fingers and then do anything before you wash your hands, we've got words. We've got words.
Yeah.
But they pop back to the story and you see the eel approaching her. And then Andre's hand goes down, grabs her shoulder. And then you see this cute, it's a quick little cut, but you plop her up and then plop her down into the boat.
Right.
So from the water, she gets a little tug and then you just watch his arm bring her down into the boat. Have you noticed how many times somebody gets completely soaked in this film?
Yeah.
Head to toe?
Yeah.
It looked like she had a literal bucket of water dropped on her and now she's on the boat.
Well, she was probably in that pool, that stage pool. And then they plopped her up and put her in there, which my note was like, so in the story, did she just like sit in that wet dress for the rest of the evening?
With all those layers that would have happened at least 500 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so next morning, everybody's dry. And
Inigo looks out the back of the boat again and he's just like, he's gaining on us. And then Fezzik's like, it doesn't matter. Sail on. And like yells at them and orders them around a whole bunch to try to go faster.
Right. Next morning. Indigo is like guiding the wind with the sail. And he's like, I wonder if the guy behind us is using the same wind that we're using. And Vicini's like, it doesn't matter. Look. And he points and there are these like cliffs and they're really jagged.
The cliffs insanity!
And he's like, move the thing and the other thing.
One of my top 10 quotable lines from this film. Move that thing and that other thing.
Have you ever seen The Legend of Korra?
No.
Okay, so spoilers for The Legend of Korra. There's a guy in there who's like this big like business guy who eventually like goes into movie making. And one of his catchphrases to his assistant is, Julie, do the thing. And then she does whatever he was hoping to do.
Like he doesn't give an actual direction.
No. So like, yeah, that's what it made me think of.
Do the thing.
Yeah.
Lydia, so. Do the thing. And that thing is podcasting.
Right. And so they get to the cliffs.
So they hit a rope and then all three of them are rigged around him. Vicini's in the front, like between his arms, like face to face.
Fezzik's the one who's carrying them.
To Fezzik's left side is Inigo. And behind him on this little swing, this little leather swing, hanging around his neck, like arms around his neck in that way that is really uncomfortable to carry children around where it's like,
yeah.
Buttercup's got him in it like a chokehold.
But it looks like there's this leather satchel that they put around Fezzik, mm-hmm. and then they put her in there. So I imagine that everybody kind of has their own seat.
But still, he hand over hands them up this probably 3-4-inch diameter rope mm-hmm. all the way up.
Mm-hmm.
All the way up. So then the mysterious person docks his boat behind their boat, and they're probably 100 feet up. But then he starts climbing too, like hand over hand. And the scene, he's like, go faster, go faster.
And he's like, well, I'm going as fast as I can. He's just like, but he's gaining. You were supposed to be this big colossus, yet he gains.
Well, I'm carrying 3 people and he's got only himself.
It doesn't matter. I'm just going to have to find myself a new giant.
Inconceivable, I'm sure.
And Fezzik, I like how Fezzik is so much of a like, you know, trying to placate and be nice with everybody that he's like, oh, Fassini, don't do that.
Yeah, he's a dum-dum, but he's a good one.
Yeah, like he's trying to be nice with everybody. He's trying to make everybody around him happy.
Yes.
Fezzik is such a caregiver.
Yes. He really, of all the people in the film, I'm going to give him my good, good, good boy award, because he just cares the whole time. Like, he was only unemployed in Greenland, so he had to become a thug, right?
Mm-hmm.
He was a brawler before then, like a hired guy. But, like, other than the fact that he gets a little violent for hire, like, he's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. And we're not even at the scene that is mostly surrounding Fezzik.
Okay.
So
they get to the top of the cliff.
Right. And Vicini gets pulled up. And, or no, actually, Indigo gets up first, and then he pulls up Buttercup, and then he pulls up Vicini. And as Indigo is helping Fezzik, we see Vicini cutting the rope.
Yeah, he starts cutting the rope before Fezzik gets up, which gives me a little bit of feels, but also he kind of saves time.
Mm-hmm.
And also his little tiny, tiny dagger knife is really efficient for cutting through a big twiny rope.
Yeah. So that's when we see, like, we don't actually see Fezzik and Indigo, you know, moving up the top of this cliff, but we do see Fezzik cutting the rope and then the man in black, like, climbing up. And then we see, like, the rope snap all the way and then it just, like, goes all the way down. Yeah. And so then there's silence.
They all go to the side of the... Well, except for Buttercup, who's been kind of thrown to the side in this. Okay, she's better than a sexy lamp in this film, but she is not the deepest kiddie pool you've ever soaked your toes in. You know what I'm saying?
Right, like she has very minimal agency. Like the first thing that she ever does for herself, which is kind of ineffective, but shows that she is a character who does not want to be in the situation where she's kidnapped. She yeets herself over the side of the ship.
Yeah.
But then it turns out that it was bad because it was eel-infested waters and...
Yeah, she was hoping to escape, not to die.
Right. And so she probably, like, you could very easily surmise by the fact that these are people talking about someone behind her. She's like, I wonder if I could go ahead and escape with this guy. And so, like, that's what I always kind of thought. Like, maybe if she got, like, far enough away, she could, like, swing back around. She's in the middle of a sea. So that's the way I always thought about it when I was younger, is that she's like, oh, this is my chance to escape.
Why didn't anyone chase after her in the water?
Because there are eels, Jen.
Well, because Indigo doesn't swim and Fezzik only doggy paddles.
Why doesn't Vicini do it?
Because he's a subway manager.
He's a brains guy.
He doesn't do anything like a value.
Somebody else is going to make the sausage.
Not Fassini.
You don't want to see how the sausage is made.
So up at the top, they're all looking over the cliff.
He didn't fall? Inconceivable.
And Inigo looks over at Fassini and is just like, you say that an awful lot. I don't think it means what you think it means.
To his credit, that's the last time we hear the word inconceivable.
Which applauders, if someone ever calls you out for something that you're doing, maybe go ahead and examine why you're doing it, because you may not want to do it in the future.
If you're an angry subway manager misusing the word inconceivable and someone corrects you on it, maybe you take that correction.
So what they see is this guy all dressed in black climbing up or just like holding onto the ledge. And then they
stare down at him. It's Vicini and Inigo who are looking down at him. Mm-hmm. I guess Fezzik is taking care of Princess Buttercup at the second. But he's like, he turns around and points at Fezzik and he's like, you carry the girl. You stay here. If he falls, he falls. If he gets up here, you take care of him with the sword.
An important point is that they notice that he's starting to climb, and that's when Vicini gets very worried. Because he's like, whoever he is, he's seen us with a princess and he must die. And that's why he tells Inigo that he needs to stay here to finish him off.
Mm-hmm.
So Inigo's like, well, I mean, I can do him with my left hand, but, you know, I want to do him.
I want to do it with my right hand.
Him with my right hand, but I want to do him with my left. And he's like, you know what kind of a rush we're in.
If I do it with my right hand, it ends too quick. I will not be satisfied.
Yeah, and it's like foreshadowing for the fight ahead. So then we have, you see Inigo like take out his sword and he flops between his two hands and he starts like jabbing at the air and then he like puts his sword away and he goes over and he's like, I don't think you could like speed this up a little bit. I'm like, you know, bored. Essentially, that's what it is.
He has no phone or TikTok to wait on.
I really have a lot more patience since technology has taken over my life.
Mm-hmm. It's easy when you have something to distract you. But essentially, he's just sort of like, well, I have this rope up here. I could go ahead and throw it down there. And he's like, but I don't know if you would take it because I'm only waiting around to kill you. And
that certainly puts a damper on our relationship.
I love that line. And so he's like, well, I mean, I don't know what I could tell. Like,
I swear on my life as a Spaniard.
He's like, nope, I know many Spaniards. It's not going to work. Which is like, okay.
That's racist.
And then he's like, I swear on the soul of my father, Domingo Montoya, you will reach the top.
And that's when the guy in black is like, throw me the rope.
Because you can have honor in combat. And it's such a delicious plot point.
Right. And so he takes the rope, throws it down there, and the man in black comes up and he's ready to fight. But then he goes like, no, take your time, get some rest. And then he does this thing where he takes off his very long boot and he shakes it out.
Yeah. The man in black takes off his shoe.
And these big rocks fall out, which like to this day just still make me chortle a little
bit
inside.
Every time I've shaken something out of a shoe, I'm like, yep, happens to Carrie always. It's happening to me.
And then they have banter and they talk about all these different things, like, you know, his sword. Inigo pulls out his sword and Man in Black's like, I've never seen its equal.
Yes, it's this beautiful sword. The story in the book is several pages long. It's very good. Mm-hmm. But it essentially says the exact same thing that the movie says, which is a six-finger man came and commissioned this sword from my father. And my father made it like the book. The description is glorious. It's perfectly balanced. The hilt is immaculate. It's like this glorious, beautiful art and functional piece. And then the guy comes back and offers him a tenth of the price of it. And the father's like, I can't do that. I've got this kid. I've got this life. I'm supposed to. This is my craftsmanship. I got to get paid for it. The six finger man just kills the fuck out of him and then slices Inigo's face when he tries to intervene. And now he's got a vendetta.
Right.
And he goes on a similar hero's journey as Cary Elwes in that he tries to. I mean, like, he goes through like more than a decade of training. And then because he can't find the man, he ends up being a drunk.
Mm-hmm.
And that is pretty fascinating backstory for him. But in the movie, it's just like, he gave me this. And now I'm in the revenge business. I want to kill him.
Right. And the atmosphere of the scene, as far as I'm concerned, is very like, you know, I mean, we've had all of this action in the chase. Mm-hmm. And now we are kind of like, as an audience member, I'm kind of like waiting to see how everything's going to play out. And then when you know that the man in black is still following them, it's still kind of like the tension goes down, but it's still up there. So
yes.
This whole exposition train, woo, woo, kind of like brings everything down to like this nice like simmer. And
When I watch a film, I like to call it a breath. Mm-hmm. We have a breath. Like we're not, our heart hasn't stopped racing, but we're getting to breathe so that we can refocus. Like if you get too much action in a row, you get overstimulated. If you have a breath, that happens in scenes like in Pulp Fiction where they dance at the diner. Like there's so much going on in that film, but when you get a second where you drink a milkshake and then boogie on a table or whatever, then like you as an audience member get a chance to like reflect on the character, where they were when you first met them and where they are now, how they've changed a little bit. And even if it's how they've changed in your eyes a little bit, even if they haven't developed, like it's important for us so that we can like breathe for a second, you know? So we've had our breath. Inigo shows honor in letting the Man in Black prepare for battle.
Right. He also says, you know, and I just kind of like, you know, he says one of the most relatable lines of my entire life. I just work for Fassini to pay the bills.
Corporate overlords.
Right. So it's kind of like this podcast is our hobby. His revenge is his hobby, you know, but we still work at our different jobs respectively to pay our bills.
True.
Yeah. And so they are like, well, you know, I guess we're going to have to do this fight sooner or later. We might as well do it now. And so he's like, what is it? He says, you seem a decent fellow. I hate to kill you.
You seem a decent fellow. I hate to die.
And then it's like fencing, fencing. Oh. And it's all this terrain.
Parry, thrust, parry, thrust, parry, parry, thrust, thrust, thrust.
And then they're like, I heard you use it. I see you're using Bululu's defense against me.
Well, naturally, I thought, concerning the rocky terrain, naturally, you would counter with blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. And so they go back and forth. And Indigo gets like backed into a corner. He's like, but I have a secret that you don't.
Why are you smiling? Oh, no. I have to admit, you're better than I am. But then why are you smiling?
Oh, because I have a secret that you don't know.
And what is that?
I'm not left-handed. And then he switches over to his right and he's like,
and the music in this scene is like bom 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 bom.
Yeah. And then it like goes up and it like does these like big, you know, crescendos and just and like big waves.
The
and...
soundtrack might be the best in this moment because the is so good.
And then Inigo thinks he has the upper hand, and so he backs the Man in Black into a corner. He's like, but I have a secret too. And he's
and what
like,
is that?
I'm not left-handed either. And he
blah, 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 blah. Yeah. And then okay, but as opposed to how Inigo switches hands, he throws his sword up into the air and catches it with his hand, and then it blah, 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 buzz, and then they begin the parry and thrust again.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so good.
Right. And you can see that Inigo is maybe getting a little bit stressed because he was like, but that's my thing. And so...
But when they cut to the bar... Okay, so the Man in Black blasts Inigo's sword out of his hand. And so he's like, and he turns and he looks and there's a bar. And then, like, he goes... He swings and, like, does a leg kick out and lands kind of hard. Like, kind of like he whoops, I guess you might say, mm-hmm. onto this... You can totally tell where the mats are. Yeah. And this whole scene happens two or three times.
Yeah.
They'll do a jump and land on a mat and you see all the dirt floof in a little square. And it happens for this scene. But hey, I'm all for safety, so whatever. It's not that bad. But then Man in Black's character throws his sword, it ka-tongs into a mound of dirt perfectly erect, so to speak. And then he does a leap at the same bar, does not one, but two flips, lands on the same. It's super there, a really obvious impact mat. And then he they cut to Carrie's face, like a mid-range cut, close-up. No, like long range. You don't see his feet, but you see like 3/4 of his body. And he grabs... He grabs his sword and he's just like tuh-tuh.
There is a Sean fact for this area, for this part of the plot, and he has commented on the fact that the types of attacks and defenses in the swordplay are actual real terms,
yeah,
made up in the 14th and 15th century. So there's Benetti's defense, and that refers to refraining from attacking on uneven terrain. Capoferra refers to a linear attack, the best for uneven terrain. And Tybalt, T-H-I-B-A-U-L-T, refers to angular defenses or attacks. And Agrippa refers to natural short sword movements which cancel out angular defenses and attacks.
They must have trained for weeks to get this choreography down. Or maybe just acquire the skills to be able to ad-lib it.
Yeah, because after the Man in Black just, like, grabs his sword and he's got this nice little pose, Inigo is like... Who are you? And do you remember what he says?
Oh, no, but I remember what he said. I remember what he says about masks.
Yeah. So, So while they're talking about it, he's like, why do you wear a mask? Oh, they're terribly. Oh, no, that was with Fezzik, right?
It's with Inigo. He goes, they're terribly comfortable. I feel like they're going to be all the rage in the future.
I thought that was Fezzik.
No. It's okay. Inigo. Inigo. 90% sure.
Okay. So
if I'm wrong, super hit us up on our social medias. You can email us at shockedapplaud@gmail.com or shockedapplaud at Twitter.
Yeah.
So or check out Shock Talk at the end of the month.
Right. So they
tell me who you are. I must know.
I was like, oh, he says, who are you? And he was like, no one of consequence. And he's like,
tell me, I must know.
Get used to disappointment.
Oh,
so good.
So good.
And so they go back into the fight and everything. And the man in black, you know, gets the upper hand and he throws the sword away from Inigo. And Inigo is just sort of like, all I ask is that you kill me quickly.
I would just assume as destroy a stained glass window as a piece of art like yourself. But since I can't have you following me.
Ka-dunk. Yeah. And then Inigo goes down. I have a few questions to ask you, Naomi, about this scene, because I wrote them down for my own personal use.
The questions?
I have a few questions that I would like to ask you. Well, I mean, it doesn't have to be you personally. I'll just rapid fire and they can be rhetorical questions for everybody.
I will answer any rhetorical question.
How much do you love black because of Wesley in this scene?
I have bought Jen this entire outfit short of a do-rag.
Okay, so how much did your heart break when Inigo asked to be killed quickly?
I was super cool with it. It seemed like a reasonable request at the time.
My heart broke a little bit because I didn't want him to die at all.
Well, good for you. He doesn't.
Yeah. If someone knocked you on the head, would you just play possum?
100%.
Yeah.
If someone... Okay. Life pro tip, Lydia Malcolm. Do you know how long it takes to choke someone to death?
I would think like a minute, maybe less.
It takes the better part of 5 minutes to choke someone to death. But because of our culture, because of everything you've seen, you and I and almost everyone else thinks it takes less than a minute. So if someone's choking you, struggle a bit and then fake die, because odds are they won't totally crush your trachea in that short of amount of time, but they'll think they have.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, if someone thinks they've knocked me unconscious, I'm going to let them believe it.
Okay.
I'll be like, ow. And that's how you pretend to be knocked out on a podcast.
Good to know. Take that to the bank applauders in case someone strangles you.
Oh, okay. So this is part one of the man in black speaking to unconscious people, right?
This is the first time he does it, yeah.
So, our dear Inigo is laid out on the floor. What does he say to him?
Do you need to say something, Jen?
I have an update on masks and when they will be fashionable in the future. That is actually with the scene battling Fezzik. Fezzik asks, why are you wearing a mask? Were you burned with acid or something? And the man in black says, no, I just think they're terribly comfortable. I think everyone will be wearing them in the future.
My bad. Sorry, guys. Thanks for the fact check, Jen.
Oh, and I think before Fezzik and Inigo break up the first time, Fezzik does say to Inigo, don't trust people in masks, or people in masks can't be trusted. So he's like, be careful.
Oh.
So what the man in black says to Inigo while he is unconscious is, please know I hold you in the highest of regards.
Aww.
That's great. And so we go ahead and cut to Vicini seeing the man in black chasing them. And
they're from far distances in this point. So like everyone who's in chase sees it a far distance,
mm-hmm.
like hours apart or so, like an hour-ish apart.
Right. And so Vicini is, you know, angry at the fact that, you know, he bested Inigo. And so
he also doesn't have a giant to carry his shit anymore because he has to reassign a dude.
Yeah. So he tells Fezzik to go ahead and kill him his way. And Fezzik's like, great, I get to do it my way. Which is my way?
You wait until his head comes around the corner. You pick up a rock. You wait till his head comes around the corner and then you hit it with the rock.
Oh, my way is not very sportsmanlike.
But Ficini's already walked away.
Right.
At that point.
Right. And so we see the man in black coming closer and he's like, oh, this is a really rocky area and there's a lot of hiding spots. And he like starts to walk and then bam, rock gets smashed up against another
straight
rock.
Straight up explodes next to his face. And he's like, huh? And Andre, sorry, Fezzik's like, I didn't have to miss. I could throw another one. I didn't have to miss. And the Man in Black's like, I believe you.
Yeah. And so he's like, so what do we do right now? And he's like, well, we fight in the way that God intended. Skill against skill alone.
I put down my rock, you put down your sword, and we kill each other hands with hands as God intended.
Yeah.
Kill each other like civilized people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So essentially, they're going to do some fisticuffs, which, you know, the Man in Black says, I think you are... I got the script right in front of me, so I don't have to fumble on the words.
Sorry. When that winds up being like Jen's favorite part of the opening of this part of the episode, and you like have to listen to it on your car on the way to the morning, and you're like, and you just hate yourself a little bit, just know that I love it so much.
So the Man in Black says, frankly, I think the odds are slightly in your favor.
Yeah, true.
And so,
well said.
Fezzik is just like, it's not my fault for being the biggest and the strongest, and I don't exercise. And then he throws the rock.
Yeah. Yes, yeet that stone, man. It's all good. So then they get to fighting.
Right.
And it's a pretty short-lived fight, I think. Like, it's half the length of his and Indigo's fight, really.
Right. But the Man in Black goes towards him and tries to like grab him, like he's gonna like lift him off.
And he goes,
Fezzik's just like, you're doing very well. I just want you to know that so you don't feel bad before you die.
He's such a good heart.
And then the Man in Black goes between his legs and gets behind him and everything. And, you know,
he bear hugs him from behind, grabs the back of his neck and does like a chokehold again. Mm-hmm. And Fezzik does what you would naturally do is just like back into one of the stones behind him. And he's just like, you know, this isn't really fair because I'm used to fighting in groups of people. And he goes, there's a difference between when you're fighting half a dozen people and when you're fighting just one. And in that term, he falls to his knees and then falls to the ground. And now he's unconscious. And for the second time, the unconscious character is like flipped over, albeit a little more struggly.
Yeah.
And he listens for his heart. And then he says one of the greatest lines of all time, which is,
sleep well and dream of large women.
I do not envy the headache you will have when you awake. But until then, sleep well and dream of large women.
As being a large woman, or like a larger than normal woman in our society, there's a part of me that's like, yay.
I went straight to Carrie always appreciates a larger lady, even mm-hmm. if it's only for a larger man.
Yeah. So then we cut to the fight scene, the last fight scene with Indigo. Mm-hmm. And we see a completely different group of people, one of which is the prince from earlier, Prince Humperdinck.
Yes, we've seen him on a balcony, but now we get to see him in his element, which is a tracker.
My note was, no, go back to the Man in Black.
100%. Humperdinck's scenes are so self-stroking that you would think that you were on a certain channel on a certain website.
Yeah.
That I've never seen before.
And so he's like, the loser went over there, but the winner followed those tracks towards Gilda.
Did we miss a scene where he finds the horse and the Gilder soldier fabric?
That wasn't in the movie.
Oh. We haven't talked about accents in this film, but like other than the Spaniards is pretty bad. But like all of these other English accents, like Ficini doesn't even try. Andres is just like Andres' voice. Mm-hmm. Like it's hit or miss across the entire board.
Yeah. Well, Ficini is Sicilian. There's definitely no Sicilian accent there.
Yeah.
I don't know what a Sicilian accent would sound like, so it doesn't really matter. He just sounds kind of like Upper New York, where he's just like, meh.
It's Wallace Shawn. He's like a different version of Gilbert Godfrey.
If he had been played by Gilbert Godfrey, would you have been disappointed?
I don't know. I'm going to go with no.
He was like Gilbert Gottfried light for this time.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I take that back. I think I would be a little bit more annoyed with Gilbert Gottfried because could you imagine someone saying, never go up against a Sicilian when death is on the line? That's my poor Gilbert Gottfried, by the way.
I never go up against a Sicilian when death was on the line.
Yeah.
Okay, like, now you do one.
No. That's okay.
Too much of a lady for this shit. I get it.
Chris Sarandon does try for a British accent, and he's American.
Yeah, isn't Carrie Elwes American?
No, Carrie Elwes is British. So is Christopher Guest.
Mm-hmm. Is Robin Wright?
Is American.
I'm so confused.
So what do we see after that is we see this nice little layout, and Vicini and the princess are just sitting down with some bread, some cheese, some apples, and some wine.
Little gingham cloth over a rock. They're sitting at a convenient little picnic spot.
It looks delicious.
It looks really good.
And the man in black shows up, and he just starts walking forward, and he's, you know, like making like, oh, well, we can figure this out. We can talk about this. We don't. No one has to die. And it's like the only. And Vicini like puts a knife, his little like stubby knife, uh-huh, to Buttercup's neck, and she's like the only one who's
she's blindfolded,
and her hands are tied.
Mm-hmm. Her hands have been tied since the boat incident.
Vicini says, so it is down to you and it is down to me.
That is correct.
Does Man in Black say something like, let me explain, while...
Yeah, there's like some banter going back and forth, and then they eventually come to the point where they're like, so I can't compete with you physically, and you're no match for my brains. And I'm like, ye old shitlord.
Yes, the Reddit shitlord that is Vicini.
Yeah. He's smart enough to run a Subway franchise.
Don't mind Subway so much.
Sorry. I was thinking of like you know how you have these like big corporate franchises, mm-hmm, that you can buy?
Yeah.
And like someone buys that and they're like, I'm hot to trot. That's, mm-hmm, the way, that's the image that I get. So it may not be Subway. What about KFC?
Mm. No, I don't think Subway's right on.
Okay.
Right on, because it's the place you don't plan on eating at the food court at the mall, but you end up there. I work a 6-hour shift right now, and I only want to spend $5 on lunch.
Right. So they sit down, and the man in black pulls out this little like vial, like a wooden vial, and he's like, inhale this, but don't touch. And he's like, and Vicini's like, I smell nothing. And he's like, what you do not smell is called iocane powder.
It is tasteless, odorless, dissolves instantly in liquid.
And is one of the more deadlier poisons
known to man.
I did not look at the script when I said that because it is ingrained. It is etched into my brain.
Yes, if I get poisoned, it's going to be by something like this. And I don't know if it actually exists.
It's a real poison.
Really? Really, really?
Yeah.
Are you going to kill me with it?
I don't think it. I wouldn't necessarily say it originates in Australia. I think that's probably something that's like racist again.
Is that like something that William Goldman would come up with to be as just racist as possible?
That's something that a ye old shitlord from ye old Reddit would come up with. Sorry.
I would like it noted that the second internet result that I got for iocane powder directed me to Amazon.
What? Jen, are you going to kill me?
It's just because of Princess Bride mugs that have iocane powder on the thing. Contents may contain iocane powder, and it has the man in black's mask on the mug.
I need that. Could you bookmark that, please?
Iocane is noted as coming from Australia, though it is never mentioned what is the poison source. The author states that iocane powder is a fictional substance. Oh, it is fictional.
Invented. So you're not going to kill me with ignorance.
Invented for the novel. So, yeah. I could have sworn that was a real thing.
Yeah, that's how good fiction do.
Mm-hmm.
So it shall be a battle
of wits
to the death.
Mm-hmm.
Just him nodding at everything, and the music's like, duh-na.
Yeah, it's like in the fight with Inigo. There's like this whole like when he's doing the swirl on the bar, he's like the music swells and then goes down, and then goes swells every time he like goes for another twirl.
Yes, there's only a couple like curated songs ish situations, and the rest of it is just this beautifully orchestrated music that just goes with the flow of the scene.
Right.
It
makes the action feel very, like, not just the action, but just a lot of these different areas just feel very, like, cohesive.
Very well. To the death? I accept. And then the man in black approaches. He says, pour the wine. And Vicini's like, huh. And he pours the rest of one glass of wine. And he pours an entire, they show the pouring of the wine. And then the man in black takes both cups. No.
Yep, both of them.
Battle.
He
of the wits to the will.
Yeah, so
is it to the death, and then it's the iocane powder bit, and then he grabs the cups that Vicini just filled, mm-hmm, and then he turns away. Vicini's confused. Buttercup's blindfolded, and you can tell she's intensely listening, but she just sits there the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
And then he pours whatever turns back with the cups, sets them down in front of them, and he's like, all right, which cup are we going to drink from? Except he probably doesn't say it like that. And he's like, I get to drink from whatever. He's like, yeah. He's like, well, that's simple. No. All I have to do.
He says, so the battle of wits has begun when you say which cup has the poison and we both drink.
Yes. Beautiful. Simple. I love it. And he's like, Vecini's like, awesome. All I have to do is discern what I know about you and what I know about me. And then the speech begins.
And it's a speech where Vecini is just like, I just have to figure out what I know about you versus what I know about me. And then it goes through this whole like, well, you're obviously not a great fool. So you would know that only a great fool takes what's in front of him. So I can clearly not choose the wine in front of me.
But I am also not a great fool. So I can clearly not choose the wine that is in front of me.
Yeah. And so there's like this whole like back and forth about like which goblet he's going to choose. And it all ends with Vecini pretty much pointing and saying, oh, what in the world can that be?
The man in black turns and looks away. Vecini switches the glasses and he's like, haha, it must have been nothing. Well, let's drink. Me from my glass and you from yours.
And just wanted to say that the man in black turns away and he's like, what? I don't see anything. And he's over there for like a solid 6 seconds.
Yeah, he knows what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And so he turns back around. He's directed to drink from his own cup. They both do. And then the man in black leans in and he goes,
you guessed wrong.
And Vecini starts to laugh and he's just like, ha ha ha, you only think that. I'd switch the glasses when your back was turned. You made the classic of two blunders, the first of which is never fight a land war in Asia, but only slightly lesser known is you never go up against a Sicilian when death is on the line.
Thud.
Oh, that's so great. And he keels over dead.
He's still, here's the thing. If you gotta go, go with a smile on your face. I have said it from the beginning. I want an aneurysm mid-guffaw and I'll be done. Just send me out like that. That sounds amazing. Send him out with a smile on their face.
Yeah. And so after this like moment where you're just sort of like, did he win? Oh, he obviously lost. The man in black goes over to Buttercup, takes off her blindfold, undoes her hands.
Yes.
And she's like, and to think the poison was in your cup the entire time. And he was like, no, I put it in both cups. I've just been building up a resistance to iocane powder.
Yes.
And then he takes her away.
Yes, he starts her running away. I think she might ask who he is first, but it doesn't matter because he doesn't divulge that information. So then we cut back to Humperdinck over Fezzik.
You're right, because she does say, and to think the whole, like, the poison was in your goblet, and then he's like, oh, it's... Or no, she does ask him, who are you? And he's just like, no one to be trifled with.
Yes. Triflers need not apply.
And so he whisks her away and they're running through along these like, you know,
yeah, they're in
hills.
These, like, it looks like, okay, so I know they're in England somewhere, but it very much feels like New Zealand in that there are these high grounds with like these bare rocks, but this very greeny grass. But they cut back to Humperdinck. And he was like, there was a battle fought here. A giant lost and went off in this direction. Mm-hmm. And they're like, well, should we follow him? And he's like, no, only the princess matters. Only whoever's won matters.
And he jumps on this horse in a very rude way.
Okay, so he's on a little outcropping. He jumps full weight, splits onto a horse saddle. Like, rude.
Mm-hmm.
That's not... I mean, I was talking to my sister-in-law the other day, and she's like, every time you bend your knees... like to do a squat or like to take a step up a step, you're putting like 3 times your body weight on your knee joints. Fact check me. I think that sounds right. And I'm like, how much force is applied when, I mean, I've only had like little kids jump on me, right? But that 50 pounds feels like 150 pounds when it smacks you really hard.
Mm-hmm.
So like, how does a full grown man jumping on a horse make any empathetic sense? And I will note that in the book, they again and again make a big deal about how Humperdinck is the best tracker, marksman type guy in the whole of the thing. And that's why he kind of touches on it in the script, but it's not as big of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
True story.
Yeah. And so they go to Buttercup and the Man in Black, and he like throws her and says, take a break. And she's just like, if you release me, you'll get anything you ever want. And she's like, I promise you that. And he's like, what's that? A promise of a woman. And they got this banter and it's just very contentious. And he goes, so you think your greatest love will find you? And she's like, I never said he was my greatest love, but he will find you. That I know.
Yes. And she's like, I know you because of your cruelty.
That's like in the
that's the next one. That's like the next scene one, and a half away.
Yeah,
because then they cut back to Humperdinck, and then he's just like iocane powder. I'd bet my life on it.
Yeah, and at one point, like he says, "in incapable of love," and she jumps up from the sitting position and says, "I have loved more dearly than a killer like you could ever dream," and he's like about to slap her.
That was a warning, princess. Where I come from, there are consequences for a woman who lies. Okay. Wesley, in the last two scenes, so we've had like scene, cut, to, and then cut back, he said two very, very sexist things, and he's about to hit a woman.
Yeah.
Also, we've talked about how I believe in autonomy, and a lot of men have been telling her what to do with her body. I find fault with that. I don't know if it's my shocked moment, but it's gross, and I don't like it. And so he's like going to hit her.
But she like prepares for it.
Yeah, she braces.
So she is like, this is something that she has probably had to deal with her entire life. Which is really sad, but it's also sad considering who she's dealing with in this scene and how much he feels about her. Anyways, so they go, their break is short-lived, and they run off again, and
okay, between these two, this these three scenes, like he talks about, we might have missed the tell me about your love.
No. That's the next scene before the big reveal.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Oh, we have to get there. Oh,
so
Lydia.
So they're rushing through this, and it's this big back and forth between Humperdinck finding them, and it's another chase sequence essentially. Uh-huh. And so Humperdinck like takes the vial and he sniffs it, and he's like, "Iocane, I bet my life on it." And every time that comes up, I'm always like, this guy definitely did. Bassini did. He bet his life on it.
He literally bet his life on it. And Vassini's laying on the ground right there. It's so good.
And so they're like, the princess isn't too far ahead. If she is dead when I find her, I will be very put out. Anyways. And so then we come to the scene that you've been talking about where she's like, your cruelty reveals everything about you. You're the dread pirate Roberts. And he's just like, with pride. And what can I do for you? And she's like, you can die slowly, cut into a thousand pieces. And he's like, what did I do to deserve such?
You killed my love.
And he's just like, possible. I've killed a lot of people. And he's like, why don't you tell me about it?
Some rich prince like the Humperdinck or whatever.
And she's like, no, a farm boy. Poor and perfect.
I got to his face. And I've only ever seen Carrie always do this where he doesn't break face at all. But you see like this tiny little shift where it's like, I need you to tell me more. But I can't let you know who I am.
Right. But there's a part of me that kind of wonders, like, if he does. Like, okay, so I get that he is, like, he told her. So, okay, so we'll talk about it after this scene ends because I got some thoughts about it.
Do it.
So basically, he's like, oh, I think I remember this man. Does it hurt you to talk about it?
And nothing like, you could say could ever hurt me.
And so he pretty much goes into this diatribe of saying, please, I need to go back to someone who I love. And then he spoke of this woman of unsurpassing beauty. I can only assume he meant you.
Yeah, that was beautifully dismissive.
Yeah. And he was like, it's a good thing I killed him before he found out who you really are. And she's like, who am I? And he was like, faithfulness, madam. He talked of your enduring faithfulness. So tell me.
Did you wait 5 minutes before you ran off and found your prince?
Or did you wait a whole week out of respect for the dead?
She goes,
you mocked me once, never do it again. I died that day. And then we see like horses and they distract him and it's Humperdinck coming after him.
Yeah, he turns and looks at them and she goes, and you can die too for all I care. And she shoves him and he starts to tumble head first. Now they're on the top of a hill, guys. Applauders. They're on top of a hill that is probably 250 feet tall. I mean, if you're in Kansas, that's a mountain. If you're here, it's a walk to the store, but like, it's still too steep. It's probably 45 degrees, maybe even 50 degrees, maybe even 55 degrees. Like,
like it's pretty steep.
And he starts to tumble down. I'm sure they switched to a stunt person, but he starts to tumble down the hill. And Jen would, and this is how I abuse our podcast. I get Jen to say all of the things I've ever wanted my protagonist loves to say to me. Jen, could you say, just could you try to say what Wesley says as he rolls down the hill?
Oh, is this is Wesley?
Shh. We're about to find out.
As you wish.
Delicious.
And then what does Buttercup do, Naomi?
Oh, my sweet Wesley, what have I done? And she does this half swan dive down the hill. She doesn't try to scoot down on her feet. That would be too not dramatic enough for Rob Reiner. She's like, and they switch to a stunt person. And if you look really close, it's pretty obvious. but close enough. Like, I'm not super mad about it. It just kind of looks a little different. How are you going to get Robin Wright's form on a stunt person? Somebody who throws themselves off stuff for a living when she is obviously a bird bone delicate fancy flower? No, it's not going to happen. So she's just like, and he falls. Okay, so his feet are away from us. His head is towards the top of the hill. And he's just like, and she manages to slip like a few feet away, but she also lands with her feet downward, her head upwards, and she's like, ugh. I don't remember what happens next. Does she crawl towards him or does he crawl towards her?
No, we see Humperdinck saying, I think we scared him. That could mark for something about his judgment error or something. And then they go after him.
Which could cause him to make a mistake or something like that.
We see them at the bottom of the hill and Wesley comes over to Buttercup and she's just like, and he's like, can you move? And she's like, you're alive. If you want, I could fly.
Oh my gosh. And then they have like the kiss. Mm-hmm. We've seen them kiss when he was about to leave for America, mm-hmm. and then they kiss now at the bottom of a hill, and their kiss game is like pretty stinking good.
To be fair, if I was kissing either of them.
I mean either of them.
Yes, because they're both attractive people.
Can I just describe Elway's face for just a little bit?
Yes.
He's got she describes his eyes as the sea after a storm, right? And I am a sucker for hazel eyes. He's got these full lips and this fairly sharp jawline, and he's got this hair that's in a little ponytail. This man. She's got the wavy hair thing that I wanted as a child. She's got piercing blue eyes. She has a fairly strong jawline for a lady. She has not indelicately shaped lips, like just very much like the two of them are everything I've ever thought of as like the ultimate leading couple faceness.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
And so when they kiss, like all of these dreams are fulfilled.
Thank you for listening to more of our Clips of Insanity. As we finish the first half of our four-part walkthrough of this classic film, A Plotter, we've had an inconceivably fun amount of time recording this episode and can't wait to bring you even more laughs and quotable lines. Looking for more surprisingly fun and witty banter? Spyhards is a weekly podcast that decodes classic spy cinema and just released their episode on True Lies. And Cinema Recall recently pushed out a bonus episode of 5 feel-good films, including Scott Pilgrim vs. the World and Romy and Michelle's High School Reunion. Hey, this is your audio engineer and masked practitioner of media because death is on the line, Jen. Did you know that we've recently started becoming guests on other film podcasts? By following us on Twitter using @ShockedApplaud, you can stay informed when these other shows release their episodes. We also recommend new shows to follow every Friday. We'll be back for more adventure in 1 week, with part 3 of our review of 1987's The Princess Bride. From Shocked and Applaud, thank you for patroning the peculiar.